From Montpelier, Vermont, this is Public Health Radio. On today's show, our guest is John Abramson. Both on our last show and today, we're looking at his seminal book, Overdosed America. On last month's show, we discussed the takeover of medical research by commercial interests, especially the pharmaceutical industry, and how the leadership of medicine has become dependent on those commercial interests. This month, we'll look at how medical information is disseminated to the public and to community doctors, and how patients and concerned citizens should respond to this commercial takeover. But first, some news from the world of public health. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. The Food and Drug Administration announced last week that it had approved a vaccine against HPV, the human papillomavirus. The vaccine is nearly 100% effective in preventing infection with HPV strains, which cause about 3/4 of the cases of cervical cancer and about 90% of venereal warts. The full treatment course consists of 3 injections over 6 months. The vaccine appears to be quite safe and is effective for at least 3.5 years. It's unclear if people will need a booster dose thereafter. Merck, the vaccine's manufacturer, has indicated that it will charge $360 for the 3 doses. That price may make the vaccine unaffordable to uninsured women in the U.S. and to women in developing countries where the vast majority of cervical cancer deaths occur. Merck has said that it expects to work with government agencies nationally and globally to make the vaccine affordable for low-income populations. The CDC's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, which drafts recommendations for vaccination in the U.S., is scheduled to meet on June 29th to review who should receive the vaccine. It will likely be recommended for girls ages 13 through 26, but the committee will also consider recommending the vaccine for boys of the same age group. Because the vaccine does not protect against all of the HPV strains that cause cervical cancer, women will need to continue receiving Pap tests to screen for HPV and cervical cancer. More information about the vaccine can be obtained at the website of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, cdc.gov/std. The federal government is receiving requests from state officials across the country to delay implementation of a new law that will require Medicaid enrollees and applicants to confirm their citizenship. The law is set to be enforced on July 1st. Under the law, individuals seeking care through the Medicaid program will be required to show proof of U.S. citizenship, such as a birth certificate or a passport. The law's intent is to prevent undocumented immigrants from claiming to be citizens in order to receive Medicaid coverage. The Congressional Budget Office estimates that 35,000 undocumented immigrants would be eliminated from Medicaid over the next 10 years. Officials from many state Medicaid departments fear the law will create a large administrative burden, and experts predict that many Medicaid enrollees will not be able to provide the necessary documents and will lose their coverage. Those eligible for Medicaid are the poorest rung of society and the sickest, and have the highest rates of changing residences, increasing the likelihood of misplacing key documents. The new requirements are expected to prove especially difficult for older Americans and poor people born at home in rural areas who never received birth certificates. In California alone, estimates are that approximately 9% of Medicaid recipients, that's 650,000 people, will be unable to produce the requested documents and will lose coverage. This means that in California alone, the number of individuals who are likely to lose their coverage is 20 times higher than the total national estimate of 35,000 illegal immigrants who are receiving Medicaid fraudulently. Workers in emergency departments, which serve large numbers of Medicaid patients, fear that after these individuals lose their coverage, they will be unable to continue receiving medical care and medicines from their doctors, and will ultimately show up in emergency departments when their illnesses worsen. More information on the new rule is available at the Medicaid website, cms.hhs.gov. A congressionally mandated committee surveying public opinion on health insurance released a report last week. After receiving testimony from 23,000 Americans in 50 communities across the country, the bipartisan committee found that a solid majority of Americans believe that the federal government should provide at least basic insurance coverage for all Americans. Most feel that funding should be fairly distributed from income, payroll, and tobacco taxes, and from individual contributions, and that that coverage should be there regardless of employment status, age, or income. The interim report is available online at citizenshealthcare.gov. Coming up next, John Abramson and more on the pharmaceutical industry. So stay with us. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. Even those of us who are healthy and don't spend much time at the doctor's office can't help but notice the slick advertising that has taken over our television sets, imploring us to ask our doctor about any number of drugs, which in the past we might only have heard about at a medical visit. Year after year, the pharmaceutical industry ranks among the top five most profitable industry sectors. And for every one of the last 10 years, the prices of prescription drugs have been rising far faster than the consumer price index. The extraordinary profits of the pharmaceutical industry might seem acceptable if we were confident that all these drugs are really helping to prevent or treat important illnesses. But many disturbing events over the last 5 years should lead to some healthy skepticism. 3 years ago, the Women's Health Initiative completed the first well-designed, objective research on the effects of hormone replacement therapy for postmenopausal women. And we discovered that after years of promoting hormone replacement as able to stave off everything from dementia to heart disease, it turned out that there was almost no truth to any of the optimistic health claims we'd been hearing about from the drug companies. On last month's airing of Public Health Radio, John Abramson joined us to discuss his book, Overdosed America. And we learned that far from being unique, the distorted research and groundless claims made about hormone replacement therapy applied also to Vioxx, Celebrex, drugs used for dementia and cholesterol treatment, and many other types of drugs. And we reviewed the history of the takeover of the medical research establishment by commercial interests, especially drug companies. Today, Dr. Abramson is joining us again to discuss the next steps in this process, the dissemination of commercially slanted medical information to doctors on the front lines of patient care, and also to the population at large. We'll look at the history that led up to this commercial takeover, and what both doctors, patients, and citizens in general can do to improve the quality of medical information and their own health as well. John Abramson is a medical doctor, a family practitioner. For many years, he served as chairman of the Family Practice Department at the Lahey Clinic and has served on the faculty of Harvard Medical School. Over the last 5 years, Dr. Abramson has turned his attention to the near complete permeation of commercial interests into the creation and dissemination of medical knowledge. In 2004, he completed his groundbreaking book addressing this issue, Overdosed America. This book will serve as the centerpiece for today's interview. The book is available through many outlets and can be obtained through the website overdosedamerica.com. John Abramson, welcome to Public Health Radio.
Marvin, it's a pleasure to be with you.
You mentioned in Overdosed America that the dramatic political event of 1994 had a significant impact on the medical device companies. That political event was the sudden change from having the Democratic Party control both the House and Senate to the takeover by a very free market approach, a Republican Party led by Newt Gingrich, as many listeners may recall. And that evidently had a direct impact on a federal agency called the U.S. Agency for Healthcare Policy and Research, and that was the agency that had been doing technology assessment. What happened to that agency then, and has it recovered?
No, is the short answer. It has not recovered. What happened is we did have a good agency of technology assessment. The United States had the first agencies of technology assessment to test new technologies to see if they were effective and if their cost justified their use. This is essential. Now, we led the world in developing technology assessment. Unfortunately, it's a very sad history because our technology assessment became a victim of the free market in exactly the way you're describing. The beginning of the end was 1993 when the Agency for Healthcare Research did an analysis of cataract removal by ophthalmologists and suggested that more cataracts were being removed than needed to be, and the ophthalmologists ought to raise the bar for visual problems before they did cataract surgery. Well, the ophthalmologists weren't very happy about that, but nothing cataclysmic happened. But then when we got to the post-94 era, in 1996, this agency looked at back surgery. Now, there are two kinds of back surgery for a herniated disc. One is just to remove the disc, a so-called laminectomy, and make room for the nerve root. And another is called spinal fusion, where the vertebrae above and below the herniated disc are actually fixed by metal hardware so that there is no play in that joint between the two vertebrae. Now, that surgery is much more expensive, both because the surgical fees are higher, because the hardware is very expensive, and because the hospital stays are longer. And when this agency looked at spinal fusion surgery compared to laminectomy, it found that there was no difference, that there was no benefit to the spinal fusion surgery. So they called for a moratorium on spinal fusion surgery, barring exceptional cases, until there were studies that determined whether that was a good idea for patients. Now, mind you, the doctors were making bigger fees. The medical supply companies were pushing this, and they were wooing and whining and dining and partying the doctors. And all the commercial push was to do the spinal fusion, even though there wasn't good scientific evidence. So what happened when this agency issued this call for a moratorium on spinal fusion surgery is the agency got zero funded for the following year, meaning nothing. It could do nothing. No money. And it was resurrected with a slightly different name, but with the agreement that it would no longer do independent guidelines. So the results are, you can go to the web and look at guidelines.gov, and you'll get the guidelines that are directing doctors' practice. But those guidelines are the guidelines that 59% of the experts have active financial ties to the drug companies. And to give you an example of what a problem that is, the guidelines that said people should be treated with Vioxx or Celebrex after Tylenol if Tylenol is not adequate for their osteoarthritis, those guidelines were on guidelines.gov from 2000 till sometime in 2004, just before Vioxx was withdrawn, even long after Merck and the FDA knew that Vioxx was a more dangerous drug. So what you've got, as we see in so many other areas of government, is government supporting private industry to the detriment of the public's health. And my God, if there's one thing we need in this country, it's an independent agency to oversee the integrity of our medical studies and medical practice. And to show you how bad this is, Marvin, when this debacle of the Medicare drug prescription bill, which ought to be called the Leave No Drug Company Behind bill, when this bill was passed, there was an attempt to have an amendment that would put aside one penny on every $100 prescription to invest in studies that would determine which drugs were the safest and most effective and most efficient for Medicare recipients. And that amendment was voted down. A one penny tax on a $100 prescription was voted down in large part due to the help of pharma in voting it down. So we're going to spend $750 billion over the next 10 years on drugs for Medicare recipients, and we're not going to invest any of that money in determining what the real best drugs are.
Maybe 6 or 7% of our profession are active researchers, and you would consider the leaders. Mm-hmm. And you've pointed out that they now have become so permeated by commercial ties, and you could even say commercial dependency, mm-hmm. that we can't rely on
maybe
them.
Maybe we should develop a drug to help people with commercial dependency.
At any rate, I wanted to focus for a moment on what happens to doctors who are out there in practice, the say 90 or 93% of our profession, who don't do research and are just trying to treat patients, and what our immediate environment has become like in terms of how we get information.
Yeah.
And I think two of those key ways have to do with what's the important element called continuing medical education, and you can describe a little bit about that, and then the overall permeation of drug detailers and the promotional activities, yeah. of the drug industry.
And how difficult it is, how most doctors are victims of this system the same way the patients are. And really, the truth is that when I started writing Overdosed America, I thought I was going to write it for physicians, because I thought if I just explained how disordered our system of generating medical knowledge is, docs would get it, and that would cause the system to change. As I started to get into it, I realized that docs won't get it, because we doctors have been trained to believe that this system is true. It's like the way that priests, rabbis, and ministers are trained to believe that their theology is true. We're trained to believe that this system produces well-ordered science, and we may be the last people who understand it. So I changed my tactic in writing Overdosed America to write it for the public so the public could understand it, because the public is much less vested in this system producing real knowledge than the medical community is. Now, that said, it's almost impossible for doctors who aren't vested, doctors who see the big picture, it's almost impossible for them to get good data. You mentioned continuing medical education, Marvin. 70% of our continuing education is now, and we have to participate in it to maintain our state licenses, 70% is now funded by the commercial interests. And they sure don't do it for charitable reasons. They do it to sell their products. When I speak and do a slideshow, I show slides of the biggest primary care continuing education conference in the country. And you can see that there are drug advertisements before you even walk in to the building. When you register, there are drug advertisements all over the registration desks. When you walk to the lecture hall, you have to walk through an exhibition hall. There's no straight path through the exhibition hall, so you've got to zig and zag your way through this gomorrah of commercialism. It's like psychedelic. It's so bizarre. And you can't get through there without 10 ballpoint pens and golf balls and cashews and clipboards and squeezy balls and, you know, God knows what. And everyone walks out of there looking like they were paid to be a sandwich man advertising the drug industry, carrying shopping bags that have drug names on them. And my God. And then when you go to the bathroom, you know, for the women, I don't know what the inside of the women's room looked like, but a big poster right next to the entrance of the woman's room that says Trust Detrol, the number one overactive bladder brand for urgency and incontinency. And in the men's room, there's actually a poster on the steel divider between the urinals. A poster that says, I swear to God it says this, it's talking about urinary incontinency and urgency. The poster says, patients feel the difference as men are standing there at the urinal. So that's the level of commercialism that has become normative behavior at what ought to be one of the most sacred functions that doctors participate in, which is getting the latest knowledge about how to treat their patients. And it's just, you know, advertising is really about two things. One is selling products, specific products, whether it's an impotence drug or a bladder drug. But the other thing that advertising is about is more subliminal, and it's that commercialism is okay, and that's what's really happening at much of these continuing education courses. And the drug detailing, one of the mysteries that I had to solve before I turned the manuscript for my book in was why 80 or 90% of doctors talk to the drug salesman, because drug salesmen don't take care of people. They don't understand what the responsibility of actually writing a prescription and doing something to somebody's body entails. They're not scientists. They're not clinicians. And they have one purpose and one purpose only, and that's to sell more drugs. And a large chunk of their salary comes from the data that the drug companies buy from the local pharmacies about what drugs their doctors are prescribing. So they get paid by how much drug is prescribed, not by providing good information, not by providing public service, but by selling drugs. And why do doctors talk to them, besides the fact that they bring lunch to the office and they bring clocks and they bring sticky pads and they bring invitations to dinner and so forth?
And drug samples.
And drug samples, yes. But why do doctors talk to them? And I think that the reason is that doctors are just plain overwhelmed. There's no way they can keep up with the medical literature and the review articles and the guidelines and all the stuff that comes across a doctor's desk every week. This is a huge problem for a practicing doctor, how to stay up. And then these guys come in with food and tchotchkes, and they also come in with very simple to understand handouts that have very easy to understand graphs in bright colors that are brilliantly designed so that the message comes across that this is what the scientific evidence shows, and this is what you should do to benefit your patients. And it's just like high school kids reading Cliff's Notes. It's getting the quick and easy way. The issue is that Cliff's Notes makes their money when you buy the little pamphlet, and they don't have any stake in presenting the summary of the book that you're supposed to have read in one light or another. But when a drug salesman comes, it's a summary, but the purpose of that summary is to get you to prescribe that drug. And doctors just got to realize that's not the way to get information. What's happened in a broad view is that all of the sources that doctors rely on to get their information have been infiltrated by the drug companies.
One evening, after everyone had gone home, one of the doctors in our practice actually went through every drawer, every wall, every clock in the office, material that had accumulated for years,
yep,
and filled up six boxes. And the criteria for her putting those postums and pens was, the only criterion was, did it have the name of a drug or a drug company on it?
Mm-hmm.
She filled up six boxes,
yeah, now
big boxes.
The question, Marvin, is how long did it take for that stuff to reaccumulate in your office after she did that?
Well, we've been mostly refusing it since that time.
I couldn't keep it out of my office. I couldn't keep it out. I kept saying to everybody, don't do this. Don't take the stickies. Don't take the pens. Don't take the clocks. And the drug reps are so talented at schmoozing the staff that this stuff would just reappear. It grows like fungus on the walls.
Actually, one of the things that upset me the most was when they started putting handout materials in the waiting room.
Oh, and now these TVs in the waiting room. When I go to the doctor with my elderly dad, there are actually TVs in the waiting room playing drug ads. You go, how can a doctor, a self-respecting doctor, make a few extra bucks by playing drug ads in his waiting room? You know, doctors have to take some responsibility here.
Getting back to my life as a general primary care internist, until I read your book, I had been going along on the assumption that I could rely on a second line defense. Not, in other words, if I couldn't rely on the researchers or the research papers themselves because they may be commercially biased, a second line of defense was expert panels. Often those expert panels will be convened perhaps by the National Institutes of Health to come up with a clinical practice guideline. In other words, that everyone involved knows that there's way too much research being done for the average general practitioner to keep up with. So someone convenes a panel of experts who then can say, okay, this is how we recommend to treat arthritis or high blood pressure or dementia or whatever. And I guess another disturbing level of unreliability, I guess, from my point of view, or commercialism from another point of view, commercial influence, is what seems to have gone on with the higher levels of defense, the expert panels, and even other types of professional organization like the American Heart Association or American Diabetes Association. And I was wondering if you could describe what the problem is there and how that may have changed also over the last 20 years or so.
We docs are graded according to how well we follow the clinical practice guidelines that are commonly agreed upon. There's no official process, but certain guidelines emerge, whether they're government-sponsored or whether they come out of professional doctors, professional societies, specialist societies. We're graded, and this actually happened in Vermont. I spent a couple of days in Burlington and Montpelier giving talks, and at one point I gave a talk to medical leaders and insurance leaders and so forth. And I spent my whole time talking about cholesterol and the cholesterol guidelines. I gave this talk, and it basically showed to what extent the current guidelines that suggest that somewhere around 45 million Americans should be taking cholesterol-lowering drugs, I showed how biased they were and how much they deviated from the scientific evidence for people who don't yet have heart disease, which is about three-quarters of the people taking cholesterol-lowering statin drugs. So I spent an hour going over the very fine details of this because to make the argument, if you just do sound bites, it's polemical and you got to get into the nuts and bolts of the numbers. So I give the talk and then an influential physician gets up and says, you know, I always had a sense that this was true and that we were prescribing too many cholesterol-lowering drugs and not helping our patients enough to change their lifestyle and that would really prevent more heart disease. I always had a sense that that was true. You've shown me the details, but I can't change my practice because the insurer, and he points to an insurer, the insurer is looking over my shoulder. And if I don't follow these cholesterol guidelines and put people on these cholesterol-lowering drugs, the insurer is going to ding me and give me a bad report card. And furthermore, they're going to turn me into the state legislature as not practicing according to community standards. At which point the insurer got up and said, you know, I always had a sense that these things were wrong, but we can't do anything about it because we get graded as an insurance product. And if we don't follow the guidelines, then we get bad grades and we don't sell any insurance. And furthermore, the law says that if we find you not following the guidelines, we have to turn you over to the legislature, the law. At which point a representative of the legislature got up and said, well, we have a sense that these aren't right, but we can't rewrite the laws and we have to do it. And at that moment, for me and for everybody in the room, we all understood that we're actors in this play and we have to read our script, that the ability to be critical thinkers and to look independently at these issues has been usurped. The truth is that 59% of the experts who participate in making these guidelines, 59% have active financial ties to a drug company that has a drug that's being considered. 59%. So these panels of experts are dominated by people who have financial conflicts of interest. And it came out in the cholesterol guidelines issue because they're so enormously tipped towards putting people on drugs. The lead author of the cholesterol guidelines said, look, you can have experts or you can have community doctors who don't have drug company ties, but you won't have the expertise. Well, the truth is community doctors aren't idiots. And the problem right now is that the way expertise is defined in the United States is you cannot be an expert without getting catapulted into that respected position by relationships with drug companies. You have to have those relationships to be a respected expert. So what's happening is the guidelines that set the standards for practice, those guidelines are dominated now by the drug industry and the other commercial interests. The American people are getting drastically cheated. cheated of their money and cheated of their health by this process. Now, I've spoken to the National Legislative Association for Prescription Drugs. It's a consortium of about 15 state legislatures. And last week I was down in West Virginia addressing the House and the Senate in West Virginia. And my message is that this is turning into virtually a states' rights issue, that states can act on this independently. They do not have to accept the national standards. In other words, states could band together and have their experts review the scientific literature and make their own unbiased recommendations, especially for Medicaid, where the states are paying the bills. So it's lack of understanding and passivity on the part of doctors, health policy people, legislators, and the public to let the commercial interests take control of these issues and to not earn back the democracy in this situation by public activism and playing an active role in representing the public interest.
Well, let's take a short break. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. Our guest today is John Abramson, and we're discussing his celebrated book, Overdosed America. During the second part of today's interview, we'll be discussing what response Abramson thinks non-medical people ought to make, both in their private role as patients when they're seeking medical care, and in their role as public citizens in a democracy. So stay with us. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. On today's show, we're discussing the book Overdosed America with its author, John Abramson. This seminal book lays out the step-by-step infiltration of commercial interests into every aspect of the creation and dissemination of medical knowledge, especially information related to prescription drugs. The book is available through its website, overdosedamerica.com. Now back to the interview.
I'm somewhat of a news junkie, and one source of news, among others, that I use is to watch the network evening news reports.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to say that over the last 15 years, what is going on between the news segments, in other words, the 7 minutes out of the 30 they're advertising, has changed dramatically, to say the least. And it's true on all three networks that at least half and probably three quarters of the ads, and it turns out to be a very expensive time of day to buy and to get an ad aired.
Sure.
That three quarters of those seem to be from drug companies, and that's a change. And I was wondering if you could talk about what predicated that change and then what you think's the implications of those of that type of pharmaceutical advertising that's bypassing the doctor entirely.
Yep, absolutely. And just to finish up what you were saying, that you see a high concentration on the evening news. The evening news anchors are well chosen to be trustworthy people. So what happens is we're in our most trusting mode when we're listening to the news anchors, and then these ads come in. It's like the trust center in our brain has been opened, and then the ad comes in. It's brilliant on the drug company's part. Now, what led to this? Started in 1985. There was no direct-to-consumer advertising before 1985, and the drug companies started to make the case that they should be allowed to advertise their drugs, that it was a First Amendment right and a curtailment of their free speech. And the drug ads came in slowly. First, You just had ads, either ads for drugs, but it didn't say what they were for, to create a brand name awareness, or you had ads for a condition, but it didn't say drugs, so that you were marketing, basically marketing symptomatology almost. And the change came twofold. One was in 91, when they allowed drugs to be marketed and say what they were for, but there had to be lengthy disclaimers about the side effects. 91 is when it really started. And between 91 and 2000, drug advertising went up 40-fold on TV. It was $55 million in 91, and now we're spending $4.2 billion on it. So it's gone up, you know, like
100-fold.
Yeah, 100-fold almost. Yep, yeah. 80-fold or whatever. But the real floodgates opened in 1997, and it was only a technical change by the FDA that opened the floodgates. And that was that they changed the rules so that you could advertise a drug and advertise what it's for and not have only a brief list of disclaimers and send you to a magazine. So now when you see the ad and it's advertising a drug and it says, see our ad in Shape Magazine, well, I've never seen Shape Magazine. I don't know where you find it. But you can defer to other sources. And that happened in 97, and that's really when the floodgates opened. And that's when we saw Claritin emerge. As remember, Claritin was the antihistamine that didn't cause sedation. We saw Claritin emerge as the first drug born of this new advertising era. Now, and Claritin was a huge bestseller. The truth about Claritin is it was sold in a 10-milligram dose. The 10-milligram dose was 11% more effective than a sugar pill, and the FDA had suggested to the manufacturer that they test a 40-milligram dose because it might be much more effective and helpful for people, and the manufacturer refused to because if they tested 40 milligrams, if they marketed 40 milligrams, then they wouldn't be able to market the drug as not being sedating. And what was more important was to market the drug as not being sedating, not that it worked, because you could make advertisements in which it appeared to work, and the fact that it was only 11% better than placebo didn't surface until after Claritin's ride was over. So now we've got drugs that are really pushed by direct-to-consumer advertising. Nexium, the purple pill, is the latest record holder for maximum expenses in a year. And Nexium really is no improvement in over Prilosec, which now can be bought over the counter for a seventh as much. But the drug has done a magnificent job of advertising and getting people to switch from Prilosec to Nexium before the patent on Prilosec expired. And we talked about Vioxx. One of the interesting things about Vioxx, how did it get going so much? Well, that article in the New England Journal in November of 2000 was important. But Merck understood the results of its own research in March of 2000, and one of its responses was to market Vioxx so heavily in 2000 to consumers that they spent more money marketing on advertising to consumers than Pepsi or Budweiser beer spent that year, to put this in perspective. So you're marketing drugs, prescription drugs, that actually, in the case of Vioxx, was known to be significantly more dangerous than an equally effective alternative, marketing that as if it's beer or a soft drink. That's what it's come to. Now, to put this in perspective, the United States and New Zealand, which has less than 4 million people, are the only two industrialized countries that allow direct-to-consumer advertising. And foreigners who come here think it's bizarre that we have advertisements on TV for drugs because these are scientifically complex problems that doctors ought to be deciding. So it's not a given that a reasonable society has drug advertising, and I think it really begs a much bigger question, Marvin, which is the interpretation of the First Amendment. And does the commercial right of a drug company to advertise supersede an individual's right to have accurate, unbiased health information? And right now in the United States, the drug company's rights are prevailing. And in order to get this straightened out, I'm not a political scientist, but in order to get this to start moving in the right direction, there needs to be enough understanding on the public's part that the drug company's interests are being served often over and above the people's interest. When enough people understand that and hold their representatives to task, then we'll start to have some progress. Now, I got to say, you folks in Vermont are both wonderful and have given a great gift to the rest of the American people to have Bernie Sanders in Congress, because he's one of the great truth tellers about these issues. but there aren't enough, and the Congress is nowhere near moving in the right direction. In fact, they're moving in the wrong direction faster all the time.
You felt that the whole medical establishment that we've been talking about so far is so utterly permeated and dependent on drug industry money, particularly the leadership of the medical profession right now, mm-hmm. that when you wrote this book that I know you put an incredible amount of effort into, years of work on your part is obvious, that you thought about directing it toward doctors, but you felt that they were so beholden and unlikely to make anything change that you decided to tailor that book toward the general public.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to get a sense of what you'd like the public to do.
What's happening is that the informed medical consumer is subject to the same misinformation that the informed doctor is. And neither party understands that about 80% of the knowledge that they have from their most trusted sources, whether it's universities, whether it's the American Heart Association, the American Diabetes Association, the Arthritis Foundation, the Stroke Foundation, you name it, the money is primarily coming from the commercial interests, whether it's washed through nonprofits or whether it comes directly. The source of the information is primarily commercial. So one study showed that if you go on the web and get medical information, whether it's identified as commercial or not, 80% of the information has a commercial origin. So what's happening is the same way that doctors are being implored to practice evidence-based medicine, and it's really infomercial-based medicine, consumers are being implored to take charge of their own health care and to do their own research, and lo and behold, the research that they do shows that they should use commercial products. And then they feel like they're empowered consumers and go into their doctor's office and demand it. And whether it's the less sophisticated patients who believe the advertisements are telling the truth, or whether it's the more sophisticated patients who go to university and nonprofit websites and get information from there and don't understand that those sites are largely funded by drug companies, the source of the information is commercial. So I want to approach the answer to your question, what should people do, from another direction. And this is the most important part of the book. It's the last couple of chapters. You know, what the evidence really shows. What the evidence really shows is that we have been brainwashed to think that we need to depend on all these drugs to be healthy. The truth is, the Institute of Medicine, which is probably our most trustworthy public organization, the Institute of Medicine says that 70% or more of preventable mortality is the result of how we live our lives and the environment we live in. So when you look at the TV and you see all those cholesterol-lowering ads and you say, well, I'm going to get my cholesterol lower, you have become subject to the distortions of the drug industry because cholesterol is not inherently harmful. The question that you want to ask is not, what's my cholesterol, doctor? It's, doctor, how do I reduce my risk of heart disease and improve my chances of staying healthy? So 70% of health is in our own hands. The Nurses' Health Study shows that women who follow five basic health habits, exercise regularly, eat a healthy Mediterranean-style diet, don't smoke, drink in moderation, and maintain a reasonable body weight, women who do those five things have 83% less heart disease than women who don't do those things. Now, in comparison, there's not a single randomized controlled study that shows that women who don't have heart disease already benefit from taking a cholesterol-lowering drug. So you can do something that decreases your risk of heart disease by 83%, or you can take a drug that's never been shown to be helpful. And in fact, the latest meta-analysis shows it increases the risk of breast cancer by 33%. Not statistically significant, but it's there. So lesson number one for the public is, don't be brainwashed into the believing that the commercial messages are going to show you the way to good health. The commercial messages are going to show you the way to greater commercial profits. So the bottom line here, Marvin, is take responsibility for your own health, number one. Because even if the pills worked, I wouldn't be saying this, but the pills don't work. So you're wasting money, you're exposing yourself to side effects, and they don't work. And there's this huge opportunity cost where people have the opportunity to learn how to move towards good health with their doctors, but doctor and patient are misdirected towards drugs and tests. So,
and you're speaking of cholesterol medications for people who don't yet have any identifiable
heart disease,
coronary disease.
Yeah, or diabetes. People who have heart disease or diabetes. These are people for whom the statins work, but they don't work as well as a Mediterranean diet. A Mediterranean diet looks like it works 2.5 times better. Exercise is more important. Not smoking is more important. Reducing stress is more important. So even though statins do confer a benefit, and I advocate people who already have heart disease using statins, there are about 5 other healthy lifestyle habits that individually are more important than taking a statin. So if you think it's important to take a statin, please do the other 5 things first.
Do you worry that people reading your book might come away with a different message, which is that the information base that even their primary care physician is using is so tainted that maybe I shouldn't even bother going at all?
I'm a little worried, Marvin, but I have taken great pains in this book to be true to the science. And I think the people who exaggerate the criticism against the drug companies and who move willy-nilly over to the natural side without good science are doing as much of a disservice as the drug companies are. So I think it's very important to be scientifically disciplined when we are critical. My goal in writing the book, and I hope that I have put enough preventions in so people don't become nihilistic, because God knows when I need medical care, I'm very grateful that we've got the medical science we do. And I started the book with a dedication to my dad, who was dying at the time I turned the manuscript in. He was dying of kidney failure because both kidneys were blocked by huge kidney stones, and at the age of 84, he was probably too weak to undergo the surgery that would save his life. And by God, the surgeons were able to get in there and take those stones out, and he's alive and happy right now, and saw me yesterday on CNN Live with Deepak Chopra talking about alternative health care. And he's had 2 years of life because of medical science. So I am not a nihilist about medical science. In fact, I believe strongly in it, so strongly that I think we ought to follow it. But what my goal is to have people go to their primary care docs and have both parties understand that we don't know all the answers and that we need to use some common sense in making the decisions and the approach to specific problems and prevention in general. We all need to use some common sense, and that doctors and patients are in this boat together. And if I can get people to relate to each other as human beings, one a patient and one a medical practitioner, in a way that allows them to use their individual knowledge, the patient about him or herself, the doctor about medical science, with the humility to understand that most of what we believe to be true is commercially tainted, and then to use common sense, then I will have accomplished my goal in writing Overdosed America.
So far during this interview, we've discussed largely pharmaceutical industry influence over both the leaders and the regular grunts on the front line in the medical profession. But unfortunately, this also extends to technology, medical technologies. In other words, not merely medications, but there's another industry segment, the medical supply industry, for example, orthopedic devices, artificial heart valves.
Sure.
And your father may have had stents put in to deal with the urinary outflow obstruction that he suffered from. So there are companies that make these devices, and there's especially large amount of this in orthopedics and in vascular medicine. And I guess the question I have, when you look at the research base behind the development and then the implementation of those devices, is it largely the same problem we confronted in the pharmaceutical industry, that there are not good randomized controlled trials?
Yeah, I agreed with you right up until the last few words. It's the same problem, in that the goal of the medical device companies and the other medical supply industries is the same as the pharmaceutical industry and the same as every other industry in the United States, which is to maximize its return on investment to its shareholders. So that what you're seeing in the book, I go over the defibrillator issue, the implantable defibrillator issue, and there is a randomized controlled study. It's a pretty good study. And what it shows is that when you put implantable defibrillators in people who've had a heart attack and their heart isn't pumping so well, you get a few extra months of life in some patients. And the cost of this is $1.5 million for every year of life that's extended, $1.5 million. And Medicare is now paying for a lot of these. Now, in the course of doing that research, I found a study done by Italian researchers in the Journal of the American Heart Association, so a good journal, Circulation, that looked at the same population of people, people who had a heart attack, heart disease, and decreased pump function of the heart. And instead of putting implantable defibrillators in for $40,000 a pop, what they did is they randomized them into exercise groups or not, and found out that the people who exercised got about three times the benefit of the people who got defibrillators. But that wasn't mentioned in the defibrillator article. So what you get is the same phenomenon that we're talking about with the drugs, where you get this selective presentation of data. So you say, oh, several months of life on the average, that's great. Don't realize that it costs $1.5 million. And what could we have done with $1.5 million for which we would have gotten a lot more than several months of life for some of the individuals in the study? What we're getting is a selective presentation of data in order to sell product instead of in order to improve our health. So wherever you look in the healthcare system, and this even goes for the nonprofit hospitals. The nonprofit hospitals make their decisions about, many of them, most of them in my experience, make their decisions about how to invest their own money based on the return they're going to get, so that building cardiac cath suites and neonatal intensive care unit beds are much more lucrative than hiring nurses to go out and help with public education about heart disease prevention, or to find women in their first trimester of pregnancy so we decrease the number of low birth weight babies. It's much more lucrative to let the low birth weight babies happen and then take care of them in a neonatal intensive care unit. So we've got virtually our entire healthcare system grows towards financial motives instead of health motives. And that's how we've gotten ourselves in the situation in the United States, where we're spending twice as much as the average of the other 22 wealthy industrialized countries, and Americans live the shortest amount of time in good health as the citizens of any of those countries. So twice as much and the shortest amount of time in good health. I think when all said and done, what's happened is there's an enormous sleight of hand, and we think that the mission of our healthcare system is to improve the Americans' health as much as we can. And the bottom line is that it's not that. It's to improve corporate bottom lines, not our health. So a result that just came out a couple of weeks ago, one of the ways we look at the health of a population is the years of life lost below age 75. Because before age 75, for the most part, deaths are not due to old age. They're due to other illnesses, not just natural aging. So that's a good way to measure the health of a population. And for all the industrialized countries, that number, the number of years that are lost where people die below the age of 75, has been going down faster. It's been going down faster in the other industrialized countries than the United States, but it's been going down in the United States. But a shocking statistic I just saw is that between 2000 and 2005, the number of years lost below the age of 75 in the United States actually increased. So that while our healthcare premiums are increasing at double-digit rates, the number of years of life lost in the United States below the age of 75 is actually going up, not down. So when we hear that we can't control costs because costs are due to new technology which brings us better health, that is so untrue. We're not using what we know about how to get good health. And particularly in the United States compared to the other countries, we are investing so much more money and getting worse health. And I think that's the real core of the crisis in American medicine. It's not how do we control costs, it's how do we improve the quality of our health care. Because if we improve the quality and if we stop relying on drugs and medical procedures that don't do the job that they promise to do, then not only will the quality of our health care and our health go up, but we'll be able to control the costs. And I think that's the real bottom line.
One interesting part of this is that as I read chapter through chapter in your book and found the evidence you present that commercial interests have taken over medical research, have contaminated the quality of expert panels, of professional associations like the American Heart Association, of the continuing medical education, every level.
Right, everywhere where this transfer of information.
Seems to be contaminated by commercial interests, drug companies and medical supply companies. And to be honest, it's very depressing, but at the end of the book, you point out that there's an optimistic side of this, that, for example, in the battle for universal health care, we're supposed to not want to have a universal health care system like all the other developed countries have because we can't afford it.
And you point out that, well, maybe that's not true.
It's not true. I mean, just look north of the border in Canada. Canada has universal health care. Canada's health statistics are better than our health statistics. And very importantly, in 1960, all Canadians and white Americans had lived the same amount of time. But since 1960, between 1960 and 2000, when the spending in the United States skyrocketed to now 16% of our GDP, 16%, where Canada only spends about 9.5% of its GDP on health care, during those 40 years, the health of all Canadians has improved faster than the health of white Americans. And African Americans are way below. So people sometimes listen to these statistics and they think, well, this is about other people. This isn't about us. Well, it is about us. And there's an article in Health Affairs called A Tip with No Iceberg, because there's this myth that there's an exodus from Canada into the United States to get health care. Well, some people come who want to pay and get their buy their way out of line. The vast majority of Canadians are very supportive of their health care system. They spend about 60% as much money as we do. They have superior health care statistics, and everybody's covered. In the United States, we've got 46 million people who don't have health insurance. We're the only industrialized country that doesn't make sure that everybody gets health insurance. We have 18,000 deaths a year because we don't have universal health insurance. Now, that's like a 9/11 tragedy every 2 months. Now, we know that 9/11 was a true tragedy and that terrorism is awful. And we also know that we lose far more lives to the fact that we don't have universal health insurance than the terrorists have taken. Every 2 months, we lose as many. So our national priorities are askew. And the real tragedy here is that about 3/4 of Americans believe we should have universal health care and are willing to pay more taxes to get it. So you say, well, why can't we have it if Americans want it? And I think to go up a level from health care, I think this is another example of how our country is not working, the democracy is not working to enact the will of the people, and this is a call for political action. Democracy is hard work. Nobody will give it to us. We've got to take it. The drug companies and the other medical supply companies are very happy to take advantage of the misinformation and the passivity of the public and doctors. And if we want to get this straightened out, it's purely a political issue. We've got to get politically involved and demand that our representatives restore the integrity of our health care and our health care knowledge.
Well, John Abramson, thank you so much for joining us on Public Health Radio.
Thanks so much for having me. Great show, and I really appreciate the opportunity to share these ideas with your listeners.
For those who would like to obtain Dr. Abramson's book, Overdosed America is available through its website, overdosedamerica.com. Well, that's it for today's show. If you want to give us some feedback, or if you missed part of today's show and want to hear it, or want to tune into any of our previous shows, check out our website, publichealthradio.org. That's one word, publichealthradio.org. Thanks for listening, and join us again next month for another airing of Public Health Radio.